This place is special.
Get asked all the time, where's your favorite place to take College Game Day? And I say every time, Eugene, Oregon. Yeah. This is the best crowd. Honestly, it's 6 in the morning here.
Yeah.
It's dark. Yeah. It's raining. They don't care.
No, they don't.
These fans right here, pound for pound, are as good as any college football fans in the country.
This program is staged to compete and to win championships.
Oregon is going to be in the championship game. Can you believe the magical season this has become?
When we watch this film, does our effort beat theirs?
Here's Bo Nix. Guns it! Touchdown, Oregon!
Been making deposits. Time to cash a check.
Sound at Austin, which is deafening for an Oregon 15-point win. Chip Kelly still does not have a win against his former school, and we say farewell.
Man, it feels great to be a Duck.
Welcome to the QB11 Show, presented by Scoop Duck, with Doug, Andrew, and J-Hop. Here are the guys with the latest scoop.
Good evening and welcome in to another edition of the QB11 Show, presented by Scoop Duck. I am Doug Scott, of course, joined, as always, by QB11. Andrew, sir, how are you today?
I'm great. I'm in the same state as you.
You are back in the home state of Oregon, right?
Yep, and I traveled safely on a Boeing aircraft.
Nice.
Things are looking up. Although I will say, so I got pretty lucky today, and I got high boarding priority on Southwest, which never happens to me. And so I got the window seat in an exit row. And I will say that the window was not, like, there was something wrong with the window. Like, it wasn't like leaking pressure, but like the way that the like fitting was on it, it like I could see the insulation behind. Like, It was all weird.
It probably was not instilling a lot of confidence.
No, not based on some of the other things that have been happening recently with the same exact aircraft.
As I always say, you keep your seatbelt buckled the whole time.
Yes.
Especially in that scenario.
Yes, very much so in that scenario. But overall, it was a safe and pleasant flight, and it's good to be home and surrounded by family, and I feel very blessed, so.
Are you cold right now?
I have been bundled up. Actually, Doug, I even made it over to the Nike employee store today because I forgot to pack socks. So I had to go buy some socks.
Did you buy anything else? Nobody... Were you disciplined and just got the socks?
So this was the least amount of money I've ever spent at the employee store. So let's start with that. I did buy two other items. So there were some pretty sweet new Oregon sweatshorts that I got. And I also got my first piece of Nike pickleball apparel. It's just a crew neck sweatshirt. So
Nike has pickleball apparel?
Yes. And
what
honestly,
is pickleball apparel?
I mean, it's just branded. It just says Nike pickleball on it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's no different than any other Nike crew neck I've ever bought. I will say, like, I know I love Nike. We love Nike on this podcast. Like, by far the least amount of stuff I've wanted to buy ever at the employee store today.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I haven't even been in the employee store for probably over a year.
It's the first time I've been since I moved out of Oregon, because I usually just use the online shopping. But
yeah, I honestly just usually go online and because I know the full selection is there. If I go to the store, it's like, crap, like, I don't know what's going to be there, right?
Yeah, I guess I was just kind of underwhelmed with the selection. It also seems like they just don't have as much variety stocked there. Maybe it's the time of year. I don't know. Maybe they're between seasons because we are kind of coming into summer here a little bit. But who knows? Last thing, we have a little housekeeping item, and I think that this has to be moved to number one priority on the show today. What is your problem with Forrest Gump, Doug?
I don't understand. I was going to actually bring that up in the listener questions at the end of the show. Like, who says I have a problem with Forrest Gump? Like,
okay, when we were this spawn on the podcast where we talked about Tom Hanks movies.
Okay.
And you weren't very high on Forrest Gump.
Forrest.
And people are asking why that is.
Okay. Forrest Gump is a very good movie. Don't get me wrong. But I will say two things about Forrest Gump. Three things. I'll say lots of things about Forrest Gump. So first of all, it's not Tom Hanks' best movie. It's not Tom Hanks' best performance. Probably not even top three best performance for Tom Hanks, but it was a very good performance. And
give me your top three Tom Hanks performances real quick.
I mean, Philadelphia, obviously. I think Saving Private Ryan I'd put up there. I'd have to go through his whole catalog. I mean, Forrest Gump's up there. You know, it's probably in the top five at least. Maybe it's top three. I'll put it at three or whatever. But I definitely put those other two ahead.
So for me, top two would be Forrest Gump and Saving Private Ryan. And then third would be a really tough battle between Castaway and...
Oh, that's a good one.
Actually, no, I think Castaway would be two.
Have you seen Philadelphia?
I don't think so.
It's a movie that nobody rewatches, right? It's pretty somber subject. But he won best actor Oscar for that the year before Forrest Gump. Incredible performance.
What was the one that he had a couple? I guess it's probably about a decade ago now, and she's getting old. Where he's the captain of the ship.
Oh, Sully. Oh no, not Sully. Sully was good too, but the Captain Phillips.
Yes, Captain Phillips was fantastic.
Yeah, that was a great movie. Yeah, I mean, he's obviously had an incredible career, lots of good movies. So going back to Forrest Gump, I don't think it has held up as well as it was a pop culture phenomenon when it came out in 1994. I think when you go back and watch it now, I don't think it has held up as well. It's basically the entire movie is an homage to baby boomer pop culture and nostalgia and sentimentality. I don't dislike the movie. I've watched it, I don't know, 10, 15 times. It's a great movie. I think it's an absolute travesty that movie won Best Picture that year, because there are two movies that came out that year that are far and away better, more important, and more meaningful movies in the history of cinema than Forrest Gump, and those are, of course, Shawshank Redemption and Pulp Fiction.
Yeah,
it's a great movie.
I've watched both of those movies substantially more than I've watched Forrest Gump. This is more of a recent one. Have you seen Greyhound?
I did see Greyhound. Yeah,
I thought that was fantastic.
It was very good. It's interesting how when you see these actors who get into their twilight years of their career and how some of them are able to continue to make quality films, and some of them really struggle with that, right? And some of them just don't try, right? They're just like, okay, I'm done, you know? And I think Hanks has done a really good job. He's had a couple misses, right? But I think he's in general done a pretty good job here in, gosh, he's got to be going on 70 now, right? I mean, he's in the 60s for sure, but I think he's done a really good job of managing his late career acting wise, and I give him a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, I was I don't know what caused this, but I went myself and girlfriend 11 went down a Morgan Freeman rabbit hole the other day. We're looking at his his catalog of movies. We're looking at his IMDb, and I feel like he's looked the same age for 25 years. he's always been the old guy.
I'll give you the crazy thing about him. Like, he really didn't break into prominence until he was in his 40s at least, right? So he definitely, most of his career was well after 45 or so. Obviously, you're right. Like, from like the mid 90s until probably the 2010 or whatever, 2015, you look the same pretty repeatedly. And you know, the other guy who really I don't think has acted a whole lot in the last decade, but also phenomenal actor, but his career also started very late, was Denzel Washington. I had no idea that he's as old as he is.
He's
like, I always thought he was like 15 years younger than he really is.
So Denzel Washington is my go. Like, if I could, and like, I'll take it even further than that. Not only do I think he's the best actor ever, But if I could hang out with anyone from Hollywood, I think it would be Denzel.
Oh, yeah. So he is 69 years old, which is crazy. So he was born in 1954. His breakthrough performance, well, he won Best Supporting Actor for a movie called Glory, which is a Civil War movie. He won Best Supporting Actor for that in 1989. So at that point, he was already 35 years old. And I remember that was the first time I'd seen him, right? And then obviously he went on to, you know, Malcolm X, Training Day, Hurricane Flight, you know.
Remember the Titans, yeah, the Book of Eli.
Just go on and on and on. Philadelphia, again, he was in that movie.
All of the Equalizer movies.
Courage Under Fire, which is one of my all-time favorites. I love that movie too, but the submarine movie with Gene Hackman, love that movie.
The Book of Eli is a banger.
Oh, Book of Eli, yeah, very underrated movie. American Gangster, right? Like, just on and on and on. But he's 69 years old, and you know, you watch him in these movies when he's in his like mid-50s, and I'm thinking that guy's 40, right? Like, he also did not age for like 20 years.
Yeah, no, I'm looking through Denzel Washington's, and he's the GOAT.
Yeah, he's really, really good.
I won't hear any argument. Like, so in terms of like my favorite actors, it has to be Denzel Washington, Tom Hardy, because I think Tom Hardy, like, he's just one of those guys that can play any role, and he gets like way into character. Like, think about it, he plays Bane, he plays Alfie Solomon in Peaky Blinders. He plays, hold on, now I got to pull up his IMDb, because his IMDb is crazy.
While you're doing that, I think about actors a lot, like I think about athletes, like you kind of put them in eras, right? And it's hard to compare across eras because like just like the way movie making works and the way acting is and stuff changes just like the way sports changes, right? Like, but I totally, you know, agree with, you know, some of your takes on, you know, people of the last, actors of the last, you know, the 90s and beyond, for sure. I think, you know, you go back to like the 70s was probably the best single decade of movie making in history. The 90s was also very good, but the 70s was incredible. And there's a lot of great actors in that era. You know, you look at Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro, like just Gene Hackman was another one that came up in that era, right? Like just Clint Eastwood, a lot of really, really, Clint Eastwood's more of a movie star than an actor, but a lot of really, really good actors in that era as well. And it's hard to compare because the movie making is so different the way they make movies.
Yeah, I mean, we're okay, really quick, because then we got to start talking about football. Who are your favorite?
Is this a football show? Wait, yeah, we talk football know. On this show? Oh, I thought we were converting into a Hollywood show.
There's very few people that I enjoy talking movies with as much as I enjoy talking movies with you.
Man.
I think you have a very sophisticated taste in movies. I think you're a little low on Forrest Gump, but
it's a very good movie.
One of my favorite movies of all time that I think is extremely underrated is No Country for Old Men. What are your thoughts on this?
I mean, the Coen brothers in general were a very underrated, set of movie makers for most of their career, right? And that was the one that I think they won Best Picture for that. And yes, I totally agree with you. It is. I actually just rewatched that maybe about a year ago now, a year and a half ago, something like that. But yes, just they are incredible filmmakers, and they have such a unique style in the way they make their movies. It's kind of Tarantino-esque in that, right? Like you put on a movie. And you wouldn't even have to know Quentin Tarantino was the maker of the movie. You'd just know by watching it. And the same way with Coen Brothers. Like 10 minutes into any Coen Brothers movie, you're like, okay, this is a Coen Brothers movie, right? But yeah, that's probably, you know, their masterpiece or certainly up there. And I mean, I don't even know the guy's name who played the bad guy in that movie. He's a Spanish actor, I think. But I mean, he was phenomenal. Phenomenal.
Oh my gosh.
And Tommy Lee Jones was great,
too. He was terrifying in that movie.
He was.
Absolutely,
like, I remember nailed it.
I was a younger kid, not young, but like I was probably 8 years old when that came out, and I watched it I was terrified. Also, Fargo is another really good Coen Brothers film. The Big Lebowski.
The first one I remember seeing was Raising Arizona. way back in the day. And it was just quirky, weird, like, it was kind of probably their first breakthrough, like, hit movie. And Nicolas Cage, I think, starred in it. What's the guy?
They also did True Grit.
They did do True Grit, and that is a really good movie. I mean, the original is great, too. I'm normally anti-remake in all things, but that is one of the very, very few exceptions that I accept.
While we're on the topic of great directors, Guy Ritchie is one of my favorites. I just like Snatch is another one of my favorite movies of all time. The cast of that movie is insane.
I'm going to have to rewatch. I'm going to be honest. I've watched Snatch once when it first came out.
Really?
And so I have no memory of that movie at all. I'm going to have to go back and rewatch it.
I mean, it's just an insane cast. I would say that's probably the best Brad Pitt movie, in my opinion.
Over Fight Club?
Yeah, I think Fight Club's super overrated, to be honest with you. It's okay.
Yeah, I could give you that.
I haven't watched it in a long time, but if you enjoy Snatch, Rock and Roll is another Guy Ritchie film that is like very similar, but and also very, very good. Not as well known, but Rock and Roll has Tom Hardy, going back to my Tom Hardy fandom, but
check that one out.
The guy was in Inception, The Dark Knight Rises, Mad Max, which I really enjoyed. Obviously, he was in Venom, but he's in Dunkirk, was a really, really good film. The Revenant, which is a total banger, it's Hardy and Leo at their absolute best. And then
Dunkirk was a visual masterpiece, like the cinematography. The shot making, right? The big shots, technically it is a almost perfect movie. The movie itself is interesting. It's an interesting concept, but just visually stunning, right? It kind of reminds me a little bit of not in some ways like Oppenheimer, right? Where
it's
just a technical masterpiece, right? But it's not. Like Oppenheimer is not a movie I'm going to rewatch a bunch of times, right? And also, I think it's a movie that, like, the theater experience watching Oppenheimer is necessary to get the full effect.
Well, I'm just like, I love a good score, and Oppenheimer's score is incredible.
The thing about Oppenheimer, I think I said this before, but the thing about Oppenheimer, the choice that was made to have there be complete silence during the Trinity test, and you had just like that 2-3 minutes of just complete silence, no score, no sound effects, no dialogue, just dead silence for that 2 or 3 minutes was an incredibly perfect choice. In that scene,
when you talk about like creative choices, that movie 1914, where it was all one continuous shot,
yeah,
entire movie. Or I think it was like two continuous shots. The
1918,
movie.
I think it was. So it's 1914, yeah. One of those. Yeah. 1917.
1917, it's 1914. Yeah.
Whatever. World War I. Know what we're talking about.
Yeah. I think Oppenheimer, though, is probably the best movie I've seen in the last 4 years. Ish.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Hollywood's kind of in a little bit of a lull, right? I mean, a lot of great movies are being made for streamers now, and like in Hollywood, it's like they're very risk averse, right? So it's like, okay, if you have some massive IP that we know will make $500 million, no matter how good the movie is, like you're going to get bankrolled. But like a lot of or horror films, like there's all these things that Hollywood will bankroll, but like a lot of risk taking is gone from Hollywood now, so it's a bit of a tough time there.
Yeah, I've heard good things about. It's probably not actually a good film, but it's probably entertaining. The new Godzilla King Kong movie I've heard is pretty solid from a couple people.
Another IP movie.
That's the thing. Like, there's and also like if you have good original IP, why would you not just do a television show?
Well, that's what. Obviously, some IPs are taking that direction, right? I mean, Star Wars obviously is the biggest example of that, where they've moved all of their original content to TV. Harry Potter, you know, they're going to do an 8-year thing on Max, to basically retelling all the stories. But I agree with you. Like, it's if I can do you know, 100 hours on television to tell an epic sweeping story, like, that is so much better than a 3-hour movie, right?
Yeah, it's
for great IP. Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, I'm kind of a nerd, so like, I want to get into the details of the story, and like, 2-hour films, it's tough to do that with. But like, I think more like documentary style stuff. So like, for example, mm-hmm. I went and saw the Bob Marley movie, which I thought was pretty good. It wasn't incredible.
Oh, is that out? I didn't want to check that out. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure it's already on streaming now. I think called One Love. That was good. Obviously, Oppenheimer was like a 4-hour movie, so but it was very good. Although I did think that they could have condensed that movie a little bit, but I just prefer like, if you're going to tell me a big epic story, then I want all the details, which means I probably need multiple seasons, and I also need like 10 episodes. So,
yeah. Oh, I'm with you there. I'm with you there for sure. You know, we'll start up our movie podcast here next. So, you know, I listen to two kinds of podcasts, QB. I listen to podcasts about college football, and I listen to podcasts about movies. That's it.
You really?
That's in my entire library. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Big time. My entire library of...
If I could recommend one podcast that's not a football podcast to people, it would be Smartless. Because I freaking love those guys. Like, so it's Job from Arrested Development and Jason Bateman. And there's another gentleman who I can't remember, but they have a lot of like big A-list celebrities on. Like, they've had Matthew McConaughey and Robert Downey Jr. And those are really fun interviews to listen to. And I also love Jason Bateman. So
yeah, I will check that out. Thanks for the advice, Smartless. That's one I haven't listened to, so I will check that one out. All right, QB, we're 20 minutes in and we haven't talked football yet, so let's get to it. Oregon, yep. Obviously, coming up on spring game here this weekend. They're one of the later spring games, just like last year, one of the later spring games in the country. They will be on the Pac-12 network for the last time as a football program on this Saturday. So I don't know. It's a 1 p.m. I don't know. I'll be there, so I don't have to worry about trying to find the Pac-12 network. But for those of you out there, there's ways to do that. DM me if you want the trick, if you don't have it, access to it otherwise. But yeah, so they're going to be playing that spring game. They're coming down to the wire here in spring practice. I think the things that we know that Oregon will be doing, as you watched a lot of these spring games over the last few weeks, what you see a lot of teams doing, right, is kind of what Mario used to do when he was here, is he never had enough people to run a real game. So it'd be offenses versus defense with some weird scoring system. And it was kind of more like a set of plays and a controlled scrimmage than an actual game. And then you see some other teams that don't tackle in their spring game. You see Ole Miss didn't have a spring game. They had like the Ole Miss games where they had like tug of war and 3-point shooting contests and dunk contests and stuff, which is kind of interesting. But Dan Lanning will have an actual game. The squad will be divided into two teams, just like last year, yellow team, green team, and both teams will have offense and both teams will have defense, and they will play a real game, and they will tackle and they will hit hard. And then the second half, they'll go to a running clock and, get some younger guys some reps.
Well, and the deal is that the team is actually really deep. So it doesn't, you can actually split the roster and still have a competitive scrimmage, which hasn't always been the case, right? Like, so I think that's really what this is going to showcase in spades, is just how much competitive depth and talent exists on the team.
So let's talk about some of the things that, obviously, it's a spring game. Play calling is going to be vanilla. We're not going to see any of the real, we're not going to get any insights into the secret playbook or, anything like that, right? But they're going to roll. They're going to have fun with it. They're going to roll out there. They'll have split squads, right? So there'll be a draft. I think they did last year, right? So it's not like the first offense is all on the same team and the first defense, they mix it up. Which I think actually makes for a really competitive and compelling game. And I know it'll be a lot of fun for fans as well in attendance. But what are some takeaways you're trying to look for in the spring game? Maybe we'll just kind of bat this back and forth. Let's start on the offensive side of the ball. What's the first thing you're looking for there?
Well, can we actually start with like overarching and then we can get more granular?
Let's do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, for me, it's like, I want competitiveness. And what I mean by that is not like coach speak. Like, I want to see effort and culture and things like that. Now, like, what I want to see is, I don't want to see busted coverages. I want to see good on good with guys making contested plays against good players. So like, I don't want to see someone 15 yards behind the defense by themselves catching a touchdown, because I know that's exciting to play catching the touchdown and the fans in the stands, but I want to see like contested competitive reps across the board.
Yeah, because that means someone missed their assignment on the other side of the ball, right?
Yeah. Yeah, like exactly. Like the Texas spring game, for example, like everyone's all pumped on Archman. Like he threw a couple posts on air. Like I want to see guys throwing the ball in the tight windows with anticipation. I want to see receivers making catches with a corner in close coverage. I want to see like corners making breaks on balls against receivers who are running clean routes. You know what I mean? Like I want to see stuff that translates on Saturdays in the fall.
Yeah. No, I think that totally makes sense. You know, I think competitive makes a lot of sense. I think you want to see, I do want to see guys playing hard, right? Like treating it like a real game. And I think we saw that in last year's spring game. I have no reason to doubt that will be the case again. I think there's going to be a lot of physicality this game. I think that's one of the things you're going to see in this game compared to a lot of spring games around the country, is there's going to be real physicality, right? There's going to be some real hits, in this game. And, you know, hopefully there's no injuries, obviously, but the reality is like Oregon runs a very physical practice. They do that intentionally. They do it in spring. They do it in fall. They do it in the season. They have a very physical mindset at the way they practice, and I think that's very intentional. And I think it's part of the DNA, right? Like, how can you expect guys to come out and turn it on Saturday if you don't build those habits all throughout the year in practice? And I think that's the Dan's approach to this program, and I think we're going to see that on Saturday.
Bloody Tuesdays, right? Like that's Tuesdays, they call it a Georgia, so they call it an Oregon. Like Tuesdays, they get after it. Pads are through full pads. We're hitting, we're tackling to the ground. We're playing real ball. We're not just like going through 7-on-7 and walk-through periods. So I think that the intensity actually gets toned down a bit for the spring game, to be honest with you. Like I'm not expecting the same type of physicality that you would get on a Tuesday practice on Saturday, because ultimately, at this point, it's like, all right, hey, let's make it through this thing healthy. Let's not take too many risks with player health. But at the same time, it's also a very competitive roster. So I think that especially as you start getting down into twos and threes, the physicality will pick up.
Yeah, I mean, guys are competing for spots, right? I mean, they're still competing for their spot in the depth chart. And quite frankly, there's probably some guys who are trying to put up some good tape if they need to, you know, take it elsewhere after the game. So, they're not just going to lay down. But I think what you're saying is right. All right, let's go to the offensive side of the ball. What are some maybe, you know, players to watch or specific things you're looking to see out of on the offensive side of the ball?
So for me, and this is going to be true on both sides of the ball, it's really not about the starters at all. I'm way more interested in the young guys. So guys that either are new to the roster or are coming off a year of development. So like seeing what Kyler Casper looks like, we've heard the reviews. I want to see what he looks like out there, if he is more physical, beating press and making contested catches. I want to see what a healthy Jordan Dickey looks like. Obviously, Evan Stewart's brand new. I'd love to see what he looks like in a Duck uniform. And then for me, it's also like, what does the depth on the offensive line look like? Because this is a loaded defensive line room that they're going against. So what do guys like Kavika Rogers, Norris Wilson, George Silva look like now that they're going to get some good reps on Saturday?
No, that's a good point. I mean, we saw in last year's game, there was a number of quarterback sacks and pressures that were given up by backup offensive linemen, right? Especially backup tackles last year. We know it was in position last year for Oregon.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to be lesser this year. Like, there's a lot of really good edge rushers on this team.
There's a lot of really good edge rushers, but I do want to see how those guys, those younger tackles compete, right? Like the guys you mentioned, like a Joris Wilson or a blanking out on the JUCO guy from last year, but you know, how are those guys competing and trying to hold up there on the edge? I think will be key. And then in the interior as well, what does that rotation look like? I mean, we're not going to see the rotation because it's going to be a mixed split squad, but you know, you're going to know who the ones and twos are pretty handily for sure. The other one you didn't mention, which I'll throw out there, is how do they try to get the, why am I blanking on names today, QB? How do they try to get the young tight end involved from Idaho? Sadiq, thank you. Kenyon Sadiq, how do they try to get him involved in the offense in this game? You know, because I think he will be
someone I'm looking at to have a breakout. I don't mean he's going to go for 80 catches or something, right? But I think he's going to have a breakout role in this year's team. I want to see kind of how that starts on Saturday.
Yeah, well, if anyone's seen the pictures from last Saturday scrimmage where he's hurdling guys, like, he's a freak. So, yeah, I agree. I think he's a player that you and I have both talked about a lot going into next year. Somebody who I think is going to have a much more prominent role than probably gets discussed. And I think that Saturday he'll probably show it as to why that is. And frankly, you've got some pretty important players in the stands from a recruiting perspective. And so I think that will influence some of the play calling, and they'll try to get Sadiq involved with Lincoln Kier sitting there.
Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't even consider that. I didn't even consider that one. I think, you know, the other thing I want to see out of the quarterbacks is all four scholarship quarterbacks have, I think, been impressive at times this spring by the words we're getting from inside the walls, which isn't a lot, but you know, you obviously you want to see Dylan Gabriel, like, you know, what is his command of the offense look like? Is he running it like a veteran? Does he look like he has full command and of that offense? Obviously you want to see what steps Dante Moore has taken from last year to this, but also, you know, Moga and Austin Nova said, right? Like there's been pretty good stuff coming out of camp about both of those guys. And Luke Moga as a true freshman, which is, you know, pretty impressive. And then Austin having taken, you know, potentially some really big steps from last year. And so I'm sure they're both going to get opportunities to run the offense in times in this game, particularly in the second half. And I'm interested to see how they both look as well.
And they're not going to be throwing to walk-ons. Like, I'm sure walk-ons will get some run in this game, but like there's 10 scholarship receivers on this team that are like all talented players. And so, like, yeah, we're going to get to see Austin Novosad throw into Ryan Pelham and Dylan Gresham and Jeremiah McClellan. And we're going to see Dante throwing to guys like Jerry and Dickey and Gary Bryant and Kyler Casper. And I think that dynamic will also be really fun to watch because there's a lot of young competitive talent in the defensive back room too. So even the young quarterbacks are going to be getting good looks both in terms of who they're throwing against and who they're throwing to.
Yeah, let's go over to the other side of the ball, because one of the positions that I just feel Oregon is incredibly deep at is corner, right? So you got Jabbar Muhammad, you got Cam Alexander. Obviously, Jaleel Florence won't be playing in this game, but he's still there. He'll be back in fall. You got Dante Manning, you know, coming back. And then you've got the younger guys. You got, you know, Sione Valalia, the JUCO transfer. You've got Dakota Fields, the true freshman. You've got, you know, then you got the other true freshmen behind them, right? So I feel like I missed somebody there too, but it's a really deep room, and it'll really be interesting to see, you know, how they compete against that wide receiver core you just mentioned, right? Like, are guys like Dakota Fields, are they holding their own against not just the freshman wide receivers that you mentioned, but some guys like Dickey or Casper, or even, you know, some of the starters like Holden or Evan Stewart, right? Like, how are they, you're going to be hitting those matchups. So how are they competing in those matchups? Not let alone the starters or the perceived starters at corner as well. So that's a room I'm really interested to watch. What about you on the defensive side?
Defensive line, just because it's like, there's like 15 guys that I really am eager to see play. Like, from redshirt freshman to true freshman to Amari Caldwell, all the edge players, I want to see the development physically and skill set wise that's taken place between year one and year two for guys like Blake Purchase and Mateo Uyunglele and Tatum Tuioti. And there's a lot of other players in that room that I've heard really good things about that I haven't gotten to see myself yet, like Jaden Moore. Yeah. And Elijah Rushing and Ashton Porter. And so the whole front seven, just like, I just am looking forward to. And again, like, competitive depth. There's 15 guys in that room that I want to watch on Saturday.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to know where to watch in every play, right? Because it's going to be like, okay, am I going to watch the interior? Am I going to watch the edge? Am I going to watch the linebackers? I'm watching this corner on receiver matchup out here. Am I going to watch Kobe Savage back in the secondary? Or Aaron Flowers? I want to see what he looks like out there, you know, against you know, top flight receivers as well. And then the run game as well. I mean, I think he's a guy we've heard some good things about this spring as well as a true freshman. So is he going to carve out a role in this defense as we get into fall?
Yeah. The other one in this, the depth at linebacker, was it the freshman, is it Devin Jackson stepping up
Is it Jerry Mixon stepping up? Like, what is the depth of linebacker going to look like? Because I think that's one of the positions where I've got questions. And then I've heard a lot of really good things about both Aaron Flowers and Kingston Lopez all spring. So getting to see those guys play some ball, I think, is going to be really fun.
Sure. I mean, you know, how long we've been talking about depth of safety being, you know, one of the primary concerns on this roster for the last several years. And if you can get even one of those two freshmen to be, as Dan says, above the line, right? Old, if you're good enough, you're old enough, and be a regular rotational player. Like, that's a huge, step up from where this team was last year at that position. And if you get both of them above the line, like, look out. I mean, that's incredible. I now have, you know, five playable safeties, right? Whereas last year you had two. I'm just counting the two safeties now. That would be a huge step up. All right. Anything else you want to look for in the spring game before we move on to our next topic?
No, I think that pretty much covers it all.
Yeah, we'll be back Sunday. We'll be breaking down that spring game, talking about what we saw, what we liked, what we didn't like. Potentially, you know, maybe talk some portal talk on, and if there's any early word on who might be hitting the portal from Oregon, or, you know, maybe there's some positions we might still need to target out there, or some guys you might be interested in. We'll talk some of that today as well. But we'll be talking about all that on Sunday night. We'll also have Max Torres on to guest. He'll give his thoughts on the spring game and kind of update us on some of the latest recruiting buzz as well. So look forward to that on our next episode. But for now, QB, let's pivot gears a little bit. Junior Adams in Oregon stay blazing hot on the wide receiver recruiting trail. Already have three commits in the 2025 class. Last episode, I think we talked about the new commit out of your neck of the woods down there, and now they've added Isaiah Mosey out of Missouri. I know you did a write-up on Scoop Deck about Mosey, but, you know, for our listeners, fill us in on what Oregon is getting with Isaiah.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Mosey, but Junior Adams and Dan Lanning, I mean, Dan Lanning was a high school coach in the state, has a long-standing relationship with Mosey's dad, who's the head coach of a pretty prominent program there in I believe, the St. Louis area. But we're getting real comfy cozy over there. We got Jeremiah McClellan at the end of last cycle. Now they're adding Isaiah Mosey in this cycle. Mosey's a big slot, in my opinion. So I think they list him as 6'1". He's probably closer to 6 foot. He's thick, probably 190, 185 pounds. Really good contact balance. He also lines up a running back for his high school. Just one of those guys where catches the ball, and it's not like a receiver where he struggles to run through arm tackles, or maybe he's not like super laterally gifted or doesn't have the best run instincts. He becomes a running back post-catch. And so I think that provides a lot of value for Oregon, given how we've been really attaching, recruiting some of these longer, more linear players on the exterior of the receiver room. So getting a guy like Mosey who can make tough contested catches, run the whole route tree, has good long speed, but I think really what makes him a high-end elite prospect is his short area quickness, his ability to change directions and make people miss in the open field.
Yeah, that seems like it had a different dynamic. Obviously, Oregon has been playing the last couple of years with slots who are, you know, more of the, like, you know, small scat variety, like a Tez Johnson. You know, like, I one of the things I think I've seen this year is that, you know, when Gary Bryant Jr. came over to Oregon last year, I think you were projecting that he'd be playing a lot more in the slot here, where you thought he was better when he was at USC. It didn't pan out that way. He played most of his snaps last year outside. I'm thinking, maybe hoping, that this year that he'll be playing more out of the slot, kind of, you know, splitting reps with Tez there. While, you know, you got guys like Casper and Dickey and Evan Stewart, you know, and Holden playing outside spots. What are your thoughts on, I know I'm diverging a little bit from Mosey, but, you know, what are your thoughts on that with Gary? And then also, does Mosey, you know, Mosey being a guy that brings a different element to the slot than Oregon currently has?
Yeah, so I think, first and foremost, I think Bryant played outside more than necessity last year. You listen to Stein's interview from, I believe, yesterday. He kind of talked about how we really only had about four guys above the line. And I think only having four guys put Bryant in a situation where you kind of had to play outside too. Whereas this year, I think we're going to be closer to 6-7 guys in the rotation, meaning that Bryant is going to be able to play in the slot and be more of a relief man for Tez Johnson. And we'll have more true outside X and Z body types like Dickey and Casper coming off the bench to relieve
Holden and Stewart, which I think will elevate Bryant's game, make him more effective, but also will make the room more effective as we'll be bigger and longer on the outside.
Yeah, did you want to touch on Mozzie's, you know, kind of being a different type of slot than we've had in the past, or did you
Like we've had guys like Mozzie. I think they're not exactly the same player, but I think Braylon Addison and Mozzie are somewhat comparable. Addison, I think, is a little bit better laterally than Mozzie, because Addison was really tough to tackle, but he also had good contact balance, which is why I make the comparison. And Mozzie's longer than Addison was. I think Addison's probably like 5'10", 5'11", whereas I think Mozzie's legitimately 6 foot, maybe a little bit longer than that. We've had a lot of like small, like twitchy little jitterbug guys in the slot recently, like going back to Jalen Redd, Charles Nelson, most recently Tez, who I think is a significantly better player than either of the guys I just mentioned. But this is more of like the old Chip Kelly style slot guys who have, who are bigger, more physical builds that can take on contact and be better perimeter blockers. So I think that's kind of the different like aspect that Mozzie brings to the table versus some of the other guys we've had recently.
Sounds good. You know, switching over to the portal side now, I think the last time we talked, you know, we'd kind of been saying that there's really only one, maybe two positions at Oregon that's probably looking at in the portal. And there's still a few scholarships over the limit for now, right? One of them obviously being a true nose tackle with experience, right? They got a lot of young guys, not a lot with experience at that position. And then the second position being potentially more safety depth. There was Jacoby Matthews hit the portal at safety from Texas A&M. I think there was a lot of buzz about Oregon and him early, but that seems to have faded quite a bit. You know, do you think that's because Oregon just doesn't see him as a guy that can help them, or is it more like they see stuff coming up in their own program, right? Like we talked about earlier with Lopa and Aaron Flowers and guys that may be ready to play earlier than they thought, or maybe a combination of both. What do you think?
So I don't think Oregon's going to take Matthews based on what I've been told. And honestly, the more Matthews tape I watched, the less I was intrigued by Matthews. Everyone looks at the fact that he was the number one safety in the 22 class and gets all excited about him. But when you watch his film at A&M, like, it would be kind of like taking a true freshman, in my opinion, just from where he's at developmentally. Like, he's very sloppy technically. He doesn't show a lot of interest in tackling, which was kind of shocking to me because on his high school tape, he was a very physical player. And he just kind of throws himself at people's legs and isn't, I don't know. He's not a very good open field tackler on tape at A&M. He's very raw technically as a coverage guy. I think that a lot of the hype around him, and I think this is proving to be true just given the teams that are recruiting, but also if you look at the list of teams that it's kind of choosing to pass, that as a prospect now going into his third year of eligibility, I think he's just a lot more raw than what Oregon would prefer. I think if you're going to take a guy like that, go get a high school player where you have 4 years or 5 years of a clock to work with. Why would you do that with a guy who probably has an expectation that he's going to go pro after this year?
Well, and I'll just say this, after having, you know, the pleasure of sitting in Chris Hampton's room a couple times and listening to him give some coaches clinic, you know, stuff as well, like if you're not a willing tackler, you're not going to throw yourself in there, you're not going to play for that guy. Like, that's a big part of what he believes as a defensive back coach. I mean, it's any good defensive back coach, right? You got to tackle, but yeah, you're not going to play for him if you're not going to be an aggressive and willing tackler.
Yeah, I everyone was like, I've been in some spaces, I've talked to some Duck fans, and again, like, I'm not, here's the deal, like, I'm not expecting everyone to watch a ton of film on everybody that goes in the portal, but there's been a lot of assumptions like, oh yeah, like we Matthews is an obvious take and he'd come in, he'd start over Ty Sheam. It's like, absolutely not. Like, first of all, like the obvious take part, like, again, he obviously has physical ability, he looks the part, but when you turn on the film, like, there's nothing about him that makes him better than the guys that we have starting in safety. He's certainly not, he's not even in the same stratosphere of Savage right now. And I think he needs a lot of work to be a comparable player to Tyshawn Johnson.
So I think that there was a lot of assumptions being made based on his frame, and where he was rated coming out of high school. And I'm not saying that he's a dead prospect that can't live up to that still, but there's a lot of projection that needs to be done with him at this stage.
Well, and if you're Oregon, right, like you have enough project players on, I don't say project players, you have enough development players on your roster as it is with all the talent they brought in out of the high school ranks, right? So if you're looking to the portal right now, you're looking for a ready plug and play solution, right? Like Oregon has one or two pieces they need, but they need guys who are like plug and play, not somebody to develop for the future. They've got plenty of that.
Yeah.
So let's shift over to the defensive, the nose tackle position now. Back in the original winter portal, there was a lot of interest. I think Oregon was a finalist for Derek Harmon out of Michigan State, who hit the portal back then. There was a lot of buzz that Oregon was in his top two. I think we were pretty excited about the potential of landing him to fill that kind of nose tackle spot for Oregon. Then he stayed at Michigan State and took his name out of the portal, but now he's back in it. Is Oregon getting involved here, you think? I mean, it seems to me like, obviously, no knock on Amari Washington, Ben Roberts, the other younger guys that are going to be playing that position. But if you look up and down Oregon's roster, this is a roster that's built to compete for a national title this year. And if you can upgrade from a young, very talented player with not a lot of experience to a proven starter at that position, that seems kind of like a no-brainer, right? Is he that guy?
So, if you were asking me, and obviously I have no idea what Oregon's cap situation looks like and how taking a guy like him would impact the rest of the room, I would take Derek Harmon all day, every day, twice on the Sabbath, because I think he's a clear upgrade over anybody we have on the roster, and I think he would probably put us in a position where we have arguably the best starting defensive line in the country. And I think that's where Dan wants to be, right? And so if you're looking for experienced depth or an experienced starter that you know upgrades the room and you know sets a super high floor, then there hasn't been a better option in the portal than Harmon at the nose tackle position. I think Dominic Williams from TCU would probably be the next best thing, but I still think there's a decent gap between those two players. Will Oregon get him? I have no idea. How serious is Oregon about taking him? I don't know, because I don't know how they feel about the room as it stands now. To me, it's a no-brainer, but I'm operating with half the, or not even half, like a tenth of the information. If they just love Amari Washington, if Amari Washington has taken that step this spring and they just know that with a couple more months they can have him playing at a super elite level, then maybe they won't feel the pressure to go after him super hard. But I just sitting here thinking about it, it seems if you can get him, and if it's my concern would almost be what is the actual market rate for these high end world defensive tackles right now, because there's a lot of heavy hitters with a need, and so like what is the price going to have to be? Is it something that doesn't make sense relative to what you're paying the rest of the room? And so like those are the conversations I think that are probably taking place in the HDC and in Division Street's offices right now. Is are we willing to pay for a luxury addition what teams are going to bid up for a necessity for them? Because while I think he makes us better and it's a no-brainer to take him, he's not a necessity for us in the same way that he would be for LSU, for Texas, for Miami, who don't have any defensive tackle depth at all.
Right. And there's so many like high-end programs that are, I mean, every high-end program is looking for defensive tackle help, right? Like, I mean, that's the story every year. I guess I'd argue the other way, you know, the other way you could argue this if you're, you know, inside the war room in Oregon is like, if you look at that position as being the one area where, you know, a proven high-end upgrade could vault you into having a real, real shot to win. I mean, I think Oregon has a real shot to win a national title this year anyway, but like, if you look at that as like, wow, that one position, this could be the difference between, you know, winning or losing, you know, in deep in the playoff run, like don't you just open the checkbook at that point, right? Like this is what you're building for 25 years, right? If this is the difference maker, why not go for it? If it's an extra $100,000 or $200,000, easy for me to spend someone else's money, but you know what I'm saying?
No, I don't disagree with you. To me, I'm just going to say it. And like, this isn't usually how we talk about players on the podcast. So forgive me if this offends anybody, but if you're looking at this and like, and it's like, oh, well, if we take Harmon, like it's going to piss off Ben Roberts and he's going to hit the portal. Like that's just a risk you take. But if you take Harmon and it's going to piss off Terrence Green or Amari Washington, then you don't take Derek Harmon. That's my take on this.
Yeah.
It's like, there's third order externalities that need to be considered. And so I don't know what the dynamic is in that room. What I don't want, because like, and I know Urban Meyer said this when you were there, is like the only way to develop players is to play them. And what I don't want is to put us in a position where we're burying talented players so far down the depth chart that they're not getting the developmental reps that they need in games to either one, want to stick around, but two, to hit their ceiling. And so it's a really deep and talented room. I do think that room could benefit from having a surefire stud elder statesman to anchor the middle of that room.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that plays out. I know he's visiting Miami. Also, his other defensive line, he's a defensive end teammate from Michigan State, is also in the portal, and they're traveling to Miami and Missouri both together, right?
Oh, no, they're visiting Missouri too?
Yeah, that's what I heard today, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I really – my feeling, and you never know because money is getting thrown around everywhere – but my feeling is that the Harmon sweepstakes will come down to Oregon and Ohio State.
Unless he really wants to take a lesser deal to stay with his teammate and be a package deal, maybe.
Yeah, poor play for a worse team. Like Simeon Barrow is more of a three technique, and we already have Jamari Caldwell, who, after watching Barrow, I would rather have Caldwell than Barrow. So I think we did really well in the first portal window getting our guy that position, and so. It's like we only need a nose tackle, so there's no reason for us to get involved with Farrow.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And again, we have a bunch of young guys at the three tech behind Caldwell too. So it kind of goes back to the same point you were making before about, you know, developing them and chasing them off and whatnot. And that kind of all those factors that have to be weighed in by Dan and company, which is not an easy feat. But we'll see how that plays out. I think obviously, you know, the portal is open. The portal is open till the end of the month, so about another week. Oregon has not had anybody enter the portal yet, outside of, you know, some injury stuff that happened quite a ways back. But obviously, there are a couple over the limit. I certainly expect there'll be some portal entries next week after the spring game. I guess it's just a matter of who and how many. And I think maybe that'll give us a hint, right, on if they're planning on bringing in anyone and how many people they might be planning on bringing in, depending on how many end up exiting.
Yeah, I don't think that Oregon's going to be losing anybody that is going to be like, oh my gosh, like, what are we, like, how, why is this guy gone? I think that's going to be pretty obvious, straightforward moves in the portal. I think Oregon's going to be able to retain everyone they want to retain, is where I'm going with this.
Yeah, and that's what we've seen the last 2 years, right? So this will be the third portal cycle under Dan, and what we saw the last 2 years, even the first one when people were freaking out, was that Oregon didn't lose anybody they really needed or wanted. And I think we saw that again last year. And I agree with you. We're going to see that again this year. So let's get to our listener questions, shall we?
Yep.
All right. So I put it out there. I said we have time for 5 questions, and I would take the best 5. So we might go 1 or 2 over that number. But we did get a good the first one was, why do I hate Forrest Gump, which we've already answered. So I won't count that against the 5. But thank you for throwing that at the front of the show. Let's see. First one from Kelly. This actually dovetails right on our last discussion. In the next week, we'll see a TBD number of departing ducks hit the portal. What's your expectation on the number of those that staff actually want to keep?
0.
Yeah.
I don't mean that to be dismissive. I'm like, I hope these guys like all land at good spots and have great experiences and careers elsewhere. But Oregon's not going to be losing any players they want to keep.
Yeah, I think we've seen that, you know, like, the Division Street, the NIL, the program, I think they've done an incredible job of keeping players that they want, keeping them bought in, keeping them happy, and giving them, you know, whatever they need. And I don't just mean money, right? I mean, you know, development, playing time, you know, culture, whatever, right? That's kind of helped keep everyone in the boat that they want. So I think we'll see that continue as well.
Yeah, like there was there's like a young player that like I think there was a possibility might take off, and maybe he still does, but even him, like, I think he, like, if it happens, he's at the bottom of a very talented and deep room. So, but that's kind of where I'll leave that.
Yeah. All right. What are the names of some players that you guys foresee taking the next step this year to set themselves apart from the rest of their position group?
Okay. I'll start on offense. So wide receiver, Dickey and Casper, I think, are going to emerge as like players that are so good that we aren't going to be looking for starters at their position next year in the portal. On Sadiq, I think, is going to step up and separate himself this year. I think on defense, Amari Washington is going to do that. I think there's a chance Terrence Green does that. I think in the secondary, I think Aaron Flowers will do that. Yeah, I think
I'll add one and a half more, or one more and a maybe. I think one of the freshman linebackers will. I don't know which one, you know, I think one of those will establish themselves this year. Or let's say one of the young linebackers, right? It's kind of makes me be a little too easy. And the other one I'll say, and we haven't talked about this yet, right? If he's on the team and reinstated, he's still on the team. Sorry. If he's playing this fall, I think David Austin at nickel is another one that I think we'll see step up. But obviously he's in a legal situation that is ongoing, and we won't get into all the details, but it's a pretty serious legal situation. I think there's a complicated case that's being investigated, and we'll see where that lands. But assuming he's with the team and playing this fall, I think he will be another guy that emerges.
Yeah, there's a Scoop Duck listener who says, or a board poster, who thinks that I've just been like banging the table for Dalen Austin based on his high school film. Now, like, Dalen Austin,
he's
before this incident, has been absolutely balling the F out all spring.
Yes, he has.
And Dalen Austin, assuming he's able to rejoin the team, which I'm praying he can, because I want the best for the young man, is really, 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 really good. So that's where I'll leave that.
All right. Next question from Dowie13. If you were the czar of college football, how would you enforce the transfer portal stuff?
Okay, so if I don't have to worry about antitrust and I don't have to worry about all that stuff, this is what I'd do. I would have, I think that the two window thing works, and I think it makes sense. So I wouldn't change the windows, but I would restrict the number of times that you can move without eligibility penalty, like having to sit out a year. So I would have that limited to two times during your career, so that you don't just have these situations where you have guys hitting the portal every year,
twice a year,
unless you graduate, right? Because if you graduate, I think that you should earn a third one.
Agreed. No, I think that's perfect. I think if I was to draw it up, I think I would probably agree with that in every way.
And so, I do think that it's interesting how the SEC limits interconference transfers in the second portal window. But I think that could be interesting to have in the Big Ten too.
It feels, I'm trying to decide if it's an advantage for the SEC or a disadvantage, and I see it both ways. I think it's more of an advantage than a disadvantage. Yes, because
it's an advantage for the SEC because it's basically stopping them from going after each other, and so instead they're going after
Big Ten players. Yeah,
exactly.
And
I just don't know that rule really will have any impact in the Big Ten, but that rule in the SEC certainly hurts the Big Ten.
I would tend to agree with that.
But it's not like
you can make the argument too that if a guy's unhappy and you could make the argument that it potentially could help some Big Ten teams, right? If there's a guy that wants out of his SEC program and wants to leave, and he can't go to another SEC program, maybe you can get somebody you wouldn't otherwise been able to get. But that's probably more edge cases.
Well, also, like, for example, there's a perfect example actually happening right now. So Christian Miller, a defensive tackle from Georgia, just hit the portal, and it appears to be a Bear Alexander Part 2 situation where he's going to end up at USC. So if that guy was eligible to transfer to another SEC school, I think that you would see the price on him getting bid up substantially by LSU, by Texas. Instead, I think that it's more of an isolated bidding war between Ohio State and USC, and possibly like a Florida State or a Miami. So I also think like the implications on the NIL market are interesting too with this, because if the SEC schools aren't allowed to be involved with a player, then I think their market is like artificially limited in a way that it's not if everyone's on at the table.
No, you're spot on. You know, one thing that's been interesting about the spring portal window is there was a lot of talk in March from a lot of pundits that it was going to be a massive amount of movement from, you know, like starting quality players. And we haven't seen that at all. What we've seen was basically what we saw last year, which is mostly guys who, you know, who lost out position battles or, you know, aren't going to start their third string, right? Those guys moving around, which is kind of what we've seen in the last couple of spring portals as well. So,
except the defensive tackle.
There's been a few, but this, again, it's not a massive tidal wave of starting players that are hitting the portal. It's been at that one position. There's definitely been a few really quality players, but other than that, it's been pretty minimal from an elite player status. So it's interesting. So that prognostication doesn't appear to have come true.
Yeah,
I think one of the things I heard was that quietly, behind the scenes, a lot of collectives stepped up and took care of guys that maybe would have been in that category at some of the bigger schools. So,
yeah, like, that's been talked about on some bigger national podcasts. And like, we've heard some of those rumors too about players at other teams that could have hit the portal that collectives stepped up and kept. And like, I think that's good for the sport, really. Like, I think North Carolina, the Cover 3 podcast talked about a pair of players from North Carolina today. Like, that's good. Like, I would prefer to see some of these guys stay put where they're at. And so seeing like second tier programs make commitments to keeping their players is good. Whereas like Louisville is being picked apart.
Yeah, I think what we're going to continue to see over the next
couple Michigan
years...
State is getting picked apart.
Yeah. I think what we're going to really see over the next couple of years, QB, as this money inequity starts rearing its ugly head, is you're going to start seeing what is now two tiers of FBS football become three, right? And you're going to start seeing ACC and Big 12 players be moving to the Big 10 and the best ones, right? Or many of the best ones moving to the Big 10 and SEC.
Well, it's already happening.
In the next several, it's happening at a smaller scale. I think you're going to see, an explosion of that over the next couple of years.
Well, no, like, hear me out on this. So, other than the schools that are going to be in the SEC and the Big 10 from the ACC and the Big 12, well, not the Big 12 because there are no teams in the Big 12 that will be in either of those conferences.
Yeah.
Who hasn't been poached?
No, I mean, I think there has been. I'm just saying, I think there's going to be more of it. That's all I'm saying. I think it's
going to
be more widespread.
Yeah, I just don't know that there's a lot more of it to happen. Like, I think because, like, and like Northwestern's not poaching players from anybody, right? Like, that's not going to be what's happening. Rutgers isn't going to be doing that most likely. So the only team that I've seen like really hold on to players in the ACC that I don't know will be included, and I hope they are because I really like them as a program, is Virginia Tech.
Yeah, they've done a good job. And I agree with you. I hope they, I don't know. That's a whole other topic of
I have a soft spot
but the future
for
of the sport looks like. Yeah. No, they deserve to be there. All right, let's move on. Gabe asks, Dan has done an awesome job of positioning, it's not just Dan, obviously, U of O football during a period of historic change with the NIL portal, et cetera. But with all the hand-wringing and litigation, it feels like the current moment will not last. Collective bargaining, pay-for-play, and free agency seem inevitable. What, if anything, should the staff be doing now to be ready for this next phase of the evolution of college?
Nothing, because Oregon's way ahead of everybody on all this.
Yeah, you stole the answer out of my book. I think we're doing it. I mean, clearly, we've been out in front on this wave, along with some others, right? But we're one of the few programs that's been out in front on the portal and NIL and this current version of college football. And honestly, I think what comes next is more of just an evolution of what the current version is. I don't think it's not like it's going to veer in some vastly different direction, right? You're talking about moving NIL from collectives to in-house, or NIL from NIL to employees. Like that's just evolutionary. It's not like, oh my God, we have to veer in some completely different direction, right? And I think Oregon is preparing for that. I think obviously the move to the Big Ten and the money that gives Oregon is a huge part of that, right? Because had you stayed in the Pac-12, and like it would have been a death knell. Like there's no way to understate how employee model is coming. We've heard all these national podcasts talking about, there's been some stories that have come out this week. The Big Ten and the SEC are planning in the very, very near future, within the next couple of years, as they settle the house case and move into some sort of revenue sharing model, they're planning on sharing around $20 million a year with players in football.
Yeah,
I think only teams that can do that at a competitive level are in those two conferences. If Oregon had stayed in the Pac-12, they'd be dead. Just like the Big 12 and all these other schools are going to be. They're not going to be able to compete.
The way I look at this is, like, the NIL as it's currently formatted will be more of an inducement mechanism. It'll be more of a bonus mechanism to hold on to your best players. And then the standard money will be like your UBI that all the players get, like your employment company. Because I have a feeling, I'm sure there will be some tier model to that, but I have a feeling that the like employment based pay is going to be more standardized across the board.
Yeah, if anything, I would expect it to be based on like, you know, years of experience or years at the school or something, right? So freshmen get X, sophomores get Y, et cetera. But I agree with you. I think it'll be more standardized. And then, yeah, maybe there's some sort of incentive programs or bonus structure or something above and beyond that. Or like you said, that's where the NIL stuff kicks in. All right, a couple more questions here. We go with three more. Ben asks, is there any chance this team is a bust?
No.
This year. I mean, there's always a chance any team could be a bust, right? Like injuries happen, like some sort of bizarre scenario runs a team off the rails, culture falls apart. The chances of that happening with this team, with its depth, and honestly, the culture at this program is incredibly strong. It is extremely low. So I agree with you. Like, I mean, this team is going to win 9, 10, 11 regular season
games.
A failure
of a season for this team is 10 wins.
Yeah.
Like, because that means that you lost both Michigan and Ohio State. Like this team is so talented and so well coached and so well prepared that they're going to roll out of bed and curb stomp the other 10 teams, in my opinion. That's like, I know that's very arrogant sounding, and I know that is very homerish sounding, but like, this team is like that.
This is a loaded team.
This team is like,
if you listen to Cover 3 podcast, you know, they were talking today. And I think Bud Elliott said something like, is Dylan Gabriel the weakest starter on this team? And then everyone quickly jumped in and said, this is not a knock on Dylan Gabriel. He's one of the best quarterbacks in the country. It's more of a testament to how strong this roster is at every other position, at every position group. And he's not wrong.
Yeah, no, Bud was commenting on like the player development and roster management. And it's like, it's elite. Like this is 1 through 85, we've said this multiple times, this is the best roster Oregon's ever had, and it's like not close at all. It's not close. Like last year was a good roster. This roster is substantially better than last year's roster. And that's with losing like Bo Nix, that's with losing JPJ, that's with losing
Troy
Franklin.
6 or 7 draft picks. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, two more questions, QB. Robert asks, as we continue to develop 2 to 3 levels of high level playable depth at all positions, how does this impact recruiting and bringing in more elite talent?
Well, it just raises the
dudes
bar.
Dudes want to play with dudes.
But it also raises the bar. So like what was a take in the 2023 class does not necessarily continue to be a take in the 25 and 24 or the 25 and 26 classes. I think the bar gets higher as there's cat on cat combat in the background of Doug's house.
You heard that. Yeah.
Yes. Is everything okay? Do we need to break up a fight?
No, we're okay. They're just playing. They're fine now. But no, okay. You're spot on. The bar is raised, you know, like you said, who's the taker now, but also like what we've seen at these programs that assemble elite talent, right? Ohio State, Georgia, Alabama, et cetera. Like elite talent attracts more elite talent. And then you stack like success on top of it, right? If you have elite talent and you're making deep playoff runs, yeah, everybody wants to come. Join the show.
Yeah.
Good question there. Okay, last question. What Catholic Dan asks, what are you most excited about related to our transition to the Big Ten? Bonus, what stadium are you most excited about visiting outside of Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State? So not including those three. I know your answer.
Wait, not including Michigan, Ohio State, and Penn State?
Yeah, what stadium are you most excited about visiting, not including those three?
Okay, so I'm going to give my answer because I think everyone needs to go there, but I'm also going to give my non-cop-out answer because I'm going to give a stadium that I haven't been to yet. So, first of all, thing I'm most excited about joining the Big Ten, like the fact that the roster that Oregon's created would not have been attainable, have happened, or been like motivated to happen if we weren't in the Big Ten. So, being at the like elevating Oregon to a truly a top, probably no worse than six program in the country is what makes me happy about joining the Big Ten. In terms of, so if you haven't been to Camp Randall, Wisconsin in Madison, that is a truly awesome campus game day environment, stadium environment, like scenery, like especially if it's earlier in the year. It's going to be pretty brutally cold this year, but I'm still going to be there. And the tailgates will still be awesome, but it won't be as cool as going to a game in like September when it's beautiful and you're on the lake and all that good stuff. But Camp Randall is awesome. Wisconsin fans are great. It smokes, absolutely destroys any environment in the Pac-12 from a tailgating standpoint. Other than that, some stadiums that I'm looking forward to going to, discounting Ohio State, Michigan, and Penn State because they're the obvious ones. I really want to go to Kinnick. I think the tradition where they wave at the Children's Hospital at the end of the first quarter is one of the cooler traditions in college football. I think it's also a really cool stadium. And two more bonus answers. Sorry, Doug, not to eliminate half the conference for you, but I heard really good things about the fans that visited East Lansing and went to the Michigan State game in 2015. And Nebraska is an awesome fan base as well. So I'd love to get out to Lincoln because I didn't get to go when we played there in 2016.
So my answer is UCLA. I got to go down and sit with 10 people and watch UCLA. No, I'm joking, of course. No, you basically eliminated half the conference, as you said. So
we can have the same answer. Left.
Yeah, I mean, I was certainly thinking Iowa. I mean, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Nebraska are the obvious three that you mentioned, and Michigan State, I think, was a nice sneaky bonus one. I'm trying to think of some others there. You know, Maryland, maybe. I don't know anything about their campus or their environment, but, you know, I know that program's been playing at an interesting, you know, pretty well level the last few years. You know, maybe there's, I don't know, what's left? Illinois, I've Purdue, got a couple other Indiana, ones, anything good with those?
I mean, I've got a couple
Minnesota,
others. Like,
Minnesota, maybe? They're a passionate fan base up there.
And they've got a cool stadium. It's not huge. It's like kind of like a Washington State vibe. It's bigger than that, and it's way louder. Minnesota's cool. I would really actually like to go to Northwestern, especially once they build their new stadium. So Northwestern's super loaded. And they're building an awesome state-of-the-art stadium right on the lake. Northwestern's campus is in a pretty sweet spot in the heart of Chicago. So I think that will be a place that I absolutely want to go because I've actually never been to Chicago.
Me neither.
Other than flying like a connecting flight on the way to Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
All right. So we got a road trip planned for whenever we go to Northwestern.
Yes. And then I also, like, I don't know. It wouldn't just be about going to the game, but I know you mentioned Maryland. Maryland would be cool just because you can go do a lot of other stuff while you're up there. Honestly, feel kind of similarly about Rutgers. Go spend some time in New York.
Yeah, go to the city. Yeah.
Yeah. I think all these environments beat most of the Pac-12 environments. So to be completely frank with you, even the ones that were like even like Purdue or Illinois, like Illinois to a lesser extent, but since they have Brett Bielema, they've been better, more competitive on the field. And I think that probably reflects in fan engagement, but like Indiana Purdue is quietly a pretty nasty rivalry if you don't follow the Big Ten that closely. So I don't like, am I going to choose to go spend money traveling to Indiana? No. Am I ever going to go to a game at Indiana Purdue? Probably not, but I wouldn't be against it. All the Big Ten West teams, though, have pretty awesome home environments. I mean, you've got to be a real fan to show up and watch those rock fights.
There's nothing to do in a lot of those places, so they're super passionate about their football for sure.
Like, yeah, and like, just think about it this way: like, they're showing up to watch Wisconsin and Iowa score a combined 13 points, like 10 of the last 13 years, and they're pumped to do it. So,
yeah, it's a different breed for sure. All right, going back to the first part of the question, you know, related to our tradition of the big, I mean, continued relevance at the top of the sport, I think, is probably the A number one, and like, people are going to poo poo that. You know, oh, Pac-12 would have been fine. You know, it would have made the playoffs every year. Like, no, I mean, I think what's becoming more abundantly clear than ever over the last 6 months is the Pac-12 without USC, like, it would have just, and as good as Oregon is, first of all, it wouldn't be as good because we would have been that farm team that everybody's poaching, right? Because all these players want to go play in the Big Ten and the SEC. But secondly, nobody'd be watching. We'd be an actor. Nobody'd be talking about the Pac-12. It'd be 10 times worse than it's been the last 10 years. It'd just be such an afterthought. And the relevance of the program and all the work done to get the program to the point it's at right now would have been completely thrown away. And I think that's the biggest thing. But honestly, just everything, like the TV network, like the coverage, the you know, the other teams, the other fan bases, the, you know, the TV windows, like, I mean, everything. Like, we're going to get, probably in May, we're going to get some advanced time slots on some of our games. Like the Ohio State Oregon game, we'll know what network and time that is probably next month. Like, maybe same with the Michigan game, maybe a couple more, right? Like, we're going to get it. Like, and those games are going to be hyped, like, in a way we've never seen before. So just the being the center, being at the center of the football universe, like, that is incredibly important, and you can't diminish how critical that move is for the future of this program and quite frankly athletics at Oregon as a whole.
Yeah. All right, QB,
I think we have.
This is how long have we been going?
Well, we've had an hour of football and about 20 minutes of movies, so an hour 20 total.
I hope people actually listen through the 20 minutes of movies to get to the football talk.
I do too. It was fun. I enjoyed that a lot.
We'll have to check the analytics on this one afterwards.
We will. We'll be back on Sunday again with Max Torres as a special guest. QB and I will talk about the spring game and probably some portal stuff, and we'll go from there. QB, follow him at QB11SD on Twitter, or X as it's now known. You can follow me at Douglas TS. Follow the show at QB11 Show. Find us wherever podcasts are heard. Thank you so much for listening. Good night, everyone. There we go.
Well done, Doug.
Well done, sir. That was fun.
That was fun. I enjoyed that. I feel like we're getting back into a good rhythm. I'm going to go hang out with my mom for a little bit before she goes to bed because she's got work tomorrow. And then I'm probably going to fire up a space here a little bit if you want to hop in.
Okay, I'll look for it. Hey, one other quick thing on Sunday. I can record with Max separately, and then you and I can do later in the evening. I can sit
here. Yeah, yeah. So my thing is, I think we have to check out of our Airbnb by like 10, and then what, Astoria to Portland is like a 3-hour drive?
Yeah, two.
2-hour drive? Yeah, it's like 2-hour drive, yeah. So
I just don't know. I don't know exactly what my family's plan is. There's a lot of moving pieces there, so I can't commit to anything before like 5, probably. So sounds good, brother. All right, man. I'll chat with you a little bit later.